Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. We have another special guest this week in David Leach, who is principal of energy consulting firm ITK. Specialising in analysis of electricity, gas and decarbonisation drawn from 33 years experience in stockbroking research and analysis for UPS, JP Morgan and predecessor firms, David is a regular contributor to Renew Economy, a leading source of energy news and analysis.
Yep, so we've got David Leach on the line today. This is our second renewable energy podcast in 2 weeks. Not to sort of try and harp on the same topics, what we saw last week was a lot of the on the ground views with an installer and some of the technology side. What we really wanted to jump to this week was an expert in terms of the Australian energy markets and a bit of more of a global look at energy markets and more about the regulatory issues around that and what we're seeing in terms of that side of the energy market and renewable energy market.
After the interview, we'll then look at some of the wider investment implications that these themes can impact on how we invest money every day here at Nucleus Wealth. So join Nucleus Wealth's Head of Investments, Damien Klassen, and myself, Tim Fuller, as we dive into David's thoughts on the evolution of energy markets and where the future lies for renewable energy. I hope you enjoy. Today on the show, we have Head of Energy Consulting Group, ITK, and 33-year veteran of the Australian energy markets, David Leach. Welcome to Nucleus Investment Insights.
Hi, and thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. I should say I'm a 33-year veteran of energy markets. I have a 33-year career in investment banking in research, and for about half of that time, I was covering utilities and rated quite well in the main Greenwich survey, or at least the teams I led did, but also in building materials and at one stage or another infrastructure. Cheers.
You sound like just the man we need to be speaking to. I thought we might just start with if you could offer a little bit of background on yourself and your consulting company, if you like.
Yeah, sure. So ITK Consulting, when I left UBS in 2016, I swore I wasn't going to go into consulting, but then someone rang me up the next day and offered me $10,000 and so for a day's work. So I figured I had to give it a go. But basically, I wanted to put something back into the community. I had a long career in stockbroking and a family, and I hadn't left any time to do anything else. And I felt that there was a big gap in the market between people who were sort of very green sympathies and empathies, but didn't necessarily have the hard numbers and analysis to see where things were going. So we thought there was a space there, and it's gradually evolved into a consultancy where we advise some large companies but also offer an electricity pricing service in conjunction with my colleague Ben Whittlesey, who used to run coal research at Wood Mackenzie and did his own business for a while quite successfully, and so we've kind of linked up. So that's us.
Fantastic.
Excellent. So I guess what we're trying to look at, I guess, mainly today, we've got this thesis that solar plus batteries are sort of the killer app of the energy world in terms of scalability and at the right cost. So I guess given the right, you get the batteries plus you get solar down to the right levels, and you can basically for the purposes of the energy that we have at the moment, you can scale that as much as you like. And that given that we've sort of been seeing prices falling sort of 20% per annum over the last sort of 10 years, we've actually hitting this level now where the solar prices have got so low that what really matters now is, solar can keep falling, even if it keeps falling at that sort of 10 to 20% per annum, doesn't make as much of an issue now because it is so low. What matters now is the battery side. And on the battery side, what we're seeing is those same types of cost reductions have been flowing through, and we're starting to reach the level where if the current trends keep continuing, then within the next sort of 4 or 5 years or earlier in sunny climates, you'll hit the part where you get that parity, and that sort of means that it's very hard then for commodity prices to go up, because every time they go up, you've got this price sort of weighing down on you as the that solar plus batteries. And then on the and then you flip that around to the residential side, where on the residential side, obviously because it's much smaller scale, it is a lot more the costs are a lot higher, but they are also coming down very quickly. And while the costs are a lot higher, what you have to offset is also a lot higher because the price at the utility level is so much lower to the price at the residential level. And so, so that's sort of where coming from our perspective. And I guess I just wanted to sort of get some of your thoughts on some of the technology side, and or I guess if you've got any sort of broad thoughts on that thesis, I guess where you see issues with it, or agree, I suppose.
Well, I actually think it's a little more complicated than that, to be honest. And I guess the stock market's famous for where great you can go broke waiting for a good idea to happen. A lot of times, there are so many different commodities. So, I mean, you could look at lithium as a commodity, for instance, and it might do very well in the battery market if there wasn't so much supply of it right now. The fact is that solar and batteries are marginally solar by itself is clearly competitive electricity, but the big problem with solar, of course, it's all generated at the same time, so there's an absolute limit to how much solar you can pump into the system unless you can work out what to do with the excess, and that's one of the challenges for the electricity system at the moment. At the utility scale, I would argue that in Australia wind is still cheaper than solar and may stay so for a few more years and will remain competitive, and certainly gets, according to our ITK numbers, at the moment at least, wind earns higher revenue. So cost is not the only driver of value, as I'm sure you know. It's the profitability we care about, and price minus cost is better for wind than solar on our numbers, and that's because the wind output is more variable across the whole of Australia. And then right now, of course, it turns out that the physical system can only take so much renewable energy because the planning has been, frankly, complete crap. We passed a law mandating 33 terawatt hours of renewable energy, but didn't put in place any of the infrastructure to actually make it happen. So right now, of course, there are massive transmission and system strength constraints that are going to be with us for some years. So, in fact, all of these carefully crafted solar farms that have done on very marginal cost of capital are seen, because of changes in their MLFs, sometimes reductions in their revenue of 20%, which, of course, screws the economics like crazy. So I think over time what we're going to see is consolidation of the industry, as in so many other industries, and those long-term stayers will emerge. We'll have to find... new ways to take advantage of the low-cost solar and still give the developers in that space a return. As far as household goes, it's certainly a very powerful force. We're up to over 9 gigawatts, to give your listeners an idea. Average in front of the meter demand at this time of year is probably a touch over 20 gigawatts. So to have 9 gigawatts of solar acting away in the background there at lunchtime is pretty powerful, and that's still growing at probably pretty close to 2 gigawatts this year, which is an astonishing number. We all thought it maxed out at 1 gigawatt of annual increases, but this year it's accelerated again, driven by high wires and poles prices and also the falling cost of the actual solar itself. I should say that that acts as a negative driver for in front of the meter, as we call it, demand. And from the wires and poles perspective, they are entitled to a regulated amount of revenue based on their asset base. So what they're seeing is this, still seeing, is the fact that as consumption falls in front of the meter, they have to put prices up to keep their revenue constant, as they're allowed to do. And that further puts an incentive in there for households and businesses to put solar in behind the thing. The battery case is not quite there at the moment, or it's very marginal. And for that reason, the battery cell is actually relatively difficult.
Oh, absolutely, it's not there at the moment. But I guess all I'm doing is extrapolating out, as we've had pretty much 20% per annum every year for battery prices falling for the last 10 years. We've got all the car makers busy out trying to improve their battery technology. We've got all the phone makers out busy trying to improve their technology. And we've got the Tesla sort of the ones who are sticking it in houses trying to improve the technology. I guess we're looking and saying, okay, well, if this keeps happening though, we only need another two or three more years of this to hit the stage where it is getting to the stage where it's where it's at parity, or is that? Do you think that's, are you expecting that to slow down?
I think that's too easy, frankly. I used to think what you just said, but I don't think that exactly anymore. What I would say is that car battery prices are certainly coming down at the rate you suggest, but all the factories are fully pretty much devoted to making car batteries happen, and there's been a lot less focus on household batteries. And in fact, since the Tesla Powerwall has been in place over the last 3 years, its price has probably gone up more than down. And that would probably be even in US dollar terms, even before we started thinking of the currency moves.
So, go on. I mean, we just saw the Lazard just had its sort of energy. I don't know whether you get the Lazard energy storage. Yeah, so they come out, and their one came out on the weekend, actually, their latest one. And so they're at odds to what you're saying. They're saying that the battery prices are still keep coming down, and probably even more so at some of the wholesale levels. So
you can go off to Solar Quotes, and they have a spreadsheet of battery prices.
Sure.
I guess
I'm looking more globally, maybe than just if there's any specific Australian issues in terms of the, maybe the currency moving down that's causing these, I guess, making the prices balancing out, I suppose, in terms of price moves.
Look, I go to all these trade shows. Look, I think you're right in the longer term, but I'm telling you right now, it's actually not happening right this second. There's a lot of resistance to it. The solar installers don't even want to install batteries because it's a hard sale, and it's much more complex for them to install it.
Yep.
So the industry training is not there, and they've got no real interest in doing it.
Yeah.
These virtual power plants that AGL tried to set up in South Australia, they had to increase the discount on it about two or three times to actually make it happen. And that's in South Australia, where residential electricity prices are some of the highest in the world. It's been, you have to remember, the batteries in Australia are completely unsubsidised in some of the places where they are being successful. And I know Lazard's looks at it on this basis, but you can't really rely on Lazard's. They do very high-level stuff themselves, if you know what I mean. It's no substitute for your own research. I've always been one to do my own work.
Yeah, sure. Are you talking about this from an Australian perspective, or is it more from a global perspective you're talking about?
Well, there are a lot of things to think about. I'll make the same point again, that car battery production and costs are going ahead in leaps and leaps of bounds. But the actual technology that's used in car batteries, which is focused more on power density, is not necessarily exactly the ideal technology to use in households, where energy density is perhaps more important. And safety is even more of a concern. So that's a minor issue. But I just don't really think the people making batteries are really focused on the residential market as their main market at the moment.
Because the costs aren't there.
Well, no. Yeah. Well, yes, partly, but mainly because the bigger opportunity, they're so busy on the car market.
Sure.
A car battery pack is... like a Tesla is, say, what's in the Tesla Model 3? Do you know? I think it's 60 kilowatt hours, isn't it?
Yep.
So, that's six houses for every Tesla, or eight houses, if you see what I mean.
Yep.
And you've got this massive demand increase for batteries for cars and even for buses, where electric bus demand is taking off in China dramatically. I think there's 800,000 or something electric buses over there already. And so they chew up enormous amounts of battery production. And so I just think that's where the effort is going, and the household battery market's going to come walking along A bit later. That's not to say that the house, the won't cost won't come down, but it's just not where the action is right this second.
Yeah, Dave, just a quick one on that. So my understanding, and I'm happy to be corrected here, is that the part of the drive to of the housing style batteries was to soak up some of the, I guess, residual, or not so much residual, but the after effects of the car boom, so to speak. So when a car battery gets to a point where, from an efficiency point of view, as you mentioned, I think it was either power, it was one or the other, in terms of delivery for a car, it starts to get to the end of its life, then it could be effectively upcycled into potentially a house battery. So in effect, I guess we've got to have the car boom before we have the house boom. Is that sort of along the lines of what you're saying there?
Well, it's I've heard that idea as well, but let me ask you this. Do you really want to have a clapped out car battery running your house?
Yeah. Well, if I get it for 20 cents on the dollar, I might think about it. But
yeah. you might think about it, but your wife's going to have something to say, believe me, when the lights don't work at 4 o'clock in the morning or something.
Yeah,
but fair. So I don't think many houses. Look, I've heard that idea, and I understand the sort of where it's coming from, and I appreciate the quote-unquote greeny sentiment and making maximum use out of it. But I suspect most house owners want to own their own brand-new battery. And, in fact, the fact that it's only going to last 8 or 10 years or the warranty number of cycles is a big deal already, even before they get to the second-hand part.
And as you said before, the issue with the car batteries are made differently because they're made to pump out as much power as they can quickly, whereas the house ones are more about a deep cycle and
you want to remember that in batteries. You want to remember that in batteries, the actual cells are only a portion of the cost. The balance of the system is important, and one of the main technology drivers that you're seeing in batteries of all sorts, but particularly household and industrial factory batteries, is driving down the balance of system. So trying to integrate them more with the solar panels and trying to minimise the amount of time that the installer has to put into actually installing it, because installing costs are go out at least $1,000 to a household. And look, there's a lot of different, I would argue, there's a lot of different models out there still for the best way to do residential batteries. One of the most exciting ideas I've seen this year is over in West Australia, where the wires and poles people have put in a street level battery. And so they get benefits from the distribution level, so minimising the amount of grid augmentation that they have to do, and they deduct those sort of benefits over the price, and then they sell it to, like, I think 60 households can all use that battery without having to pay wires and poles charges from their house to the battery and back again. Mm. And you can get a bigger battery, a Tesla Power Pack, instead of a Power Wall, which is like 20 or 30% cheaper in dollars per kilowatt hour. So there's more than one way to skin the cat. And that brings up another issue, which your listeners probably not that interested in, is about value stacking in batteries and how the regulatory system makes it difficult for any one party to get all the, take advantage of all the revenue streams that there can be. And so that you get kind of, that's one of the reasons why they're not economic, because only one party can't capture, there's a free rider kind of issue.
Mm, okay.
Yeah. And can we just step back one sec? Because I just want to work out as well. So I guess we spoke about saying, say in 10 years' time, is that how far you're thinking until you get to the stage where the batteries and solar plus battery is on a utility level?
Look, you can make your own projections. It's marginally okay in Australia now, but it's a hard sell. And as I say, residential battery prices in Australia are not actually moving down noticeably in the last 3 years. They've barely changed. So you, in other markets, it's going to be case by case. But the reason why so many battery manufacturers in Australia are interested in Australia is because residential electricity prices are very high. So, your opportunity cost is much better here than it is in somewhere like
Texas.
And
we're already the world's largest exporter of coal and gas. So why should our electricity prices be low?
it's not that for the household perspective. In fact, at the this is where your listeners will want to distinguish carefully between generation prices and costs and final delivered prices and costs to customers. So I've spent quite a bit of time looking at China's market and markets in the United States and California and in the UK and in Germany. And you need to understand that in Australia, the sort of average wires and poles cost is way higher because of our geographic distance than it is for someone in, say, Texas, so or even in China. And so, in fact, as you say, we export coal to China. So a New South Wales coal generator is essentially paying the same price for coal, give or take transport costs, as the guy who's buying the coal in China. And guess what? That means their electricity prices are much the same. The coal-fired generation units in China are cheaper to build, but their capacity utilisation is 50% at best, whereas the ones in Australia is 75 or 80% when they work, which isn't very often because they're so old. And so those two things cancel each other out, and they're both paying the same price for coal.
Interesting.
Or gas, you know, because, again, Australian Queensland LNG is exported to China and to Japan and to South Korea. And so when it's sold on the domestic market here, as we all know, it's sold at a netback price, which is essentially the export price adjusted for transport cost differences.
I know, absolutely. That's what, we're big believers in that whole, you know, that we've stuffed ourselves on the gas side by not reserving gas. And so, you're leaving. Leaving it at the mercy.
So it just means that Australian power prices are not going to go back for fossil fuels. They're never going to be as cheap as they were. And I think this is the most important point for those people that are interested in that debate, that the actual generation prices from coal and gas are never going to be as cheap as they were. The only thing that would drive coal-fired electricity prices down is a dramatic fall in the price for coal. Otherwise, because as long as China keeps importing coal, as it does, then they're going to pay import parity price there. And that's going to set the price in Australia and in Indonesia. And so there we are. But in fact, the bigger situation, as I think most of your listeners will be aware, is that essentially the coal generation fleet, which is still two-thirds of the generation that we produce in the national electricity market, that is excluding West Australia and the Northern Territory, is all got to be replaced. It's all going away within the next 15 years. And so the fundamental ultimate problem for everyone is what's going to replace it and what's going to be the price of electricity at the end of it when it's all done.
And this is where you see the renewable piece coming in. And I noticed, obviously, you put something out recently where variable renewable energy was up to nearly 20% of
over 20.
Yeah, fantastic. And so I guess, this is the bit that's going to fill the gap as coal starts to recede, or is it going to be gas?
Well, no, it's not going to be gas. I mean, what's going to happen is the energy, right? Let's distinguish between power and energy. Power is the bit that you produce at any 1 second, and energy is the amount you consume over time, so per year. So basically it's cheaper, as I think it's acknowledged by everyone, probably even Matt Canavan would acknowledge it, that the energy coming from wind and solar is cheaper, lower cost than the energy you can produce out of coal and gas at current coal and gas prices. That energy can't provide the power, say, after dark all the time. So we need firming power to compensate for it. So most of the energy and most of the price will be driven by the low-cost solar and wind. And as I said at the beginning of this podcast, the challenge is when we're all producing solar in the middle of the day and the price is zero, how to give the solar developer a return on capital that makes it worthwhile to do that and get that cheap energy into the system. And the only way, obviously, that can work is by storing it through either batteries or pumped hydro or whatever and letting it out at night, backed up by some gas for other bits and pieces of time.
And I think that's where our argument is, that if battery prices, albeit they haven't been falling in Australia, on a global basis, in US dollars is probably the part of the issue, but on a global basis they have been falling at 20% per annum, and as you said, not in the household side, but in most of that's been focused on the car side. But I guess I'd,
and on the utility batteries as well. So sorry, I just want to distinguish, utility scale. If you look at a power pack, right, which is the bigger Tesla thing, its price has come down in Australia when the Powerwall, the residential one, hasn't moved that much. And look, part of the reason is the change in standards. You know, everyone's much more antsy. So there's just a lot of teething issues to get through. And I think your basic thesis that prices will come down is going to hold true, although it's still going to be, batteries are never going to be doing the sort of a month's worth of energy, you know, at times when, I don't know, there's a continuous zero wind rainstorm or something.
Yeah, you need some sort of backup, but that's less likely to be a coal-fired power plant sitting waiting to charge up. It's more likely to be a gas or something like that, wouldn't you think, that's ready to...
Oh, look, if you're like me and put your carbon hat on, you see absolutely no chance of in the medium term. I wouldn't bet on coal. It's not to say that one won't be built, because one might be, but you wouldn't catch me putting a dollar into a coal-fired power station.
It won't be for economic reasons.
No.
Well, no, absolutely. Well, and I think that's probably where, okay, so I think we're sort of vaguely on the right path. But I guess you spoke a little bit about China, and I guess that's probably one area I'm particularly interested as well, in that there's a lot of transmission lines in China being built in the sort of northwest of China, where they've got all the coal and I guess better solar resources and better wind resources and closer to Russian gas. So a lot of power being built up there, and then transmission lines being built back to the east, with the idea, I guess, that rather than shipping the coal and the gas across and then turning it into energy on the east coast, they'll create it in the west and then ship the energy across that far. And given have you had much of a look at that from a transmission perspective and costs?
Well, certainly look at the Chinese electricity system, which is absolutely enormous, and I'm sort of cautious about saying too much. I've been to China and visited a Chinese electricity coal plant as part of when UBS used to run global conferences in, you know, like New York or Shanghai or London, and I went to those and presented at them. And so you can look at China, but I would say it's a very large market, which is bloody obvious. And I would say that one of the reasons for moving the local sort of SOx, sulfur oxide and nitrous oxide pollution on the eastern seaboard fringe was terrible, and that's one reason why they wanted to move the coal generation further west. As you say, there's the wind and the solar thing out there. Look, it's a continuous fight, as it is all over the world, between the different fuels for who's going to get access to those transmission lines. In the end, there's still Chinese developers of coal generation still want to get a return on capital, but they're really struggling. Mm-hmm. The fundamental thing I would point out, and nuclear is going quite strongly in China at the moment as well, the most fundamental issue is that right now they haven't, it's a challenge for them to keep their electricity demand growth going enough for all this new capacity coming on stream to earn a return on capital. So in this past 12 or 18 months, because the property development boom has restarted in China, something which with my building materials hat on, I feel is unsustainable in the medium term. You just can't keep building 20 million houses a year in China forever. Once that fades away...
Big supporters of that theme here as well, yes.
Once that fades away, then the demand increase in electricity is going to slow right down. And as I said before, the coal-fired electricity plant capacity utilisation is around 50% right now, and they've been struggling with these high coal prices, which have come down but are still $65-$67 a tonne. That's going to put a lot of pressure on the system.
And I guess that's the other thing we obviously had sort of must be 10, 15 years ago now, when China flipped from being a net exporter of coal to a net importer was sort of that real run-up in coal prices.
That's right. That's the most fundamental driver.
Yeah.
They're a 3.5 billion tonne thermal coal market. A 5% change is 175 million tonnes a year. Australia's thermal coal exports are what? A bit over 200 million tonnes a year all up. So that's we're the world's biggest thermal coal exporter, as far as I know. That just puts it in context.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing that always gets me with the whole China, one more tension in that market is, you know, they've got the world's largest coal resources, and on the flip side, they're the world's largest producer of solar as well. So, you know, you've obviously got, you know, internal tensions in that market from vested interest on both sides pushing their own barrow.
You asked about solar and wind cost reductions. And the easiest way to think about that is to look at the learning rate. You know what that is?
Yes, absolutely. The more you produce, the cheaper it is.
So basically, yeah, that's right. So if we're looking at what the unit cost reduces for a doubling in the installed capacity. Now, obviously, as the installed capacity globally grows and grows and grows, it takes longer and longer to get that 15 to 20% to double that capacity. And therefore, to get what typically is a 15 to 20, or in solar, it's actually been about 30% unit cost reduction. Now, in recent times, the last couple of years, global solar production has been about 100 gigawatts per year, of which China in the last year or two was as much as 50 gigawatts. So they've had quite a change in their subsidy and regulatory process. And that means they're not going to be producing 50 gigawatts. And so even though the rest of the world is picking that up, the actual annual installation rate is slowing down. And that means that the learning rate is also slowing down a bit. And in wind, I think we're down to cost reductions per year in Australia, even for a constant dollar of, 3 to 5%. And in solar, maybe 5 to 8%. So, in fact, there's only a few more years left of decent cost reductions, probably in solar and wind right now.
Yep. Yes. Switching, I guess, gears to where you look for. You know, I've sort of had this this view for a little while that the US, given it's got such low gas prices, sort of means that it's probably not the place to be looking for the future of energy, and that we're probably better off looking to Europe and I guess other markets around the world rather than the US, because they do have that particular distortion from such low gas prices. Your thoughts on where you tend to look for the next trends in energy?
So if I would rather have an aluminium plant or a data centre in Canada or Russia, which have cheap hydro, or the Middle East, which has very cheap gas, or the United States, which has very cheap gas. They're the low-cost energy centres of the world right now. If I wanted to balance, that is to have the dispatchable power to back up my solar or wind, then I'd want to have it in Europe, which has got a great hydro resource. One reason why, say, Denmark can have over 50% wind is because they can just use hydro power from Norway to back it up, at a cost of only about €3 per megawatt hour. But their wind and solar has a much higher unit cost because they don't have as much wind or sun, obviously. So in Australia, we have a fantastic wind and solar resource, but by and large, our balancing cost is a lot higher. Obviously, we've got very limited hydro, and after that, we get to batteries and pumped hydro, which where the economics are nowhere near as good. And then we could come on talk about hydrogen, which is a sort of extremely speculative topic at the moment, where you can say whatever you want and it might come true.
I've stepped aside. I guess I take the view as well with the solar. It's much easier to pick. You know, you can see all these different technologies coming up, whether it's thin film multi-junction cells and all these other ones, where everyone's got their own different rates of they're running at, their own different economics, as well as and I sort of take the view that I don't know which one's going to win, but I can see who's going to lose from this. So it's much easier to pick the loser. And I suspect that's hydrogen for me has been a bit of that. I don't know the technology well enough, but do you have a view, or do you just sort of sit on the fence on that one as well?
At the moment, I would say the cost, it's like LNG. It's very, very, very early stage. I do have some views, and I think what we will see is that if we want to make hydrogen an export industry, we're going to have to work very hard on the transport cost of it. So that's and in addition, it takes a lot of electricity at the way it's done now to do the electrolysis part, to split the water into the hydrogen and oxygen. So that process would be nice if we could have a magic breakthrough in the fundamental technology of that to reduce the amount of energy that's needed, even if it's coming from wind and solar.
Mm. So I think Ross Garneau came out recently talking about, you know, Australia, you know, similar themes to what you're saying. Australia could be a global superpower in renewable energy, and we've got great resources and all that type of along that type of road. I guess my issue is seems as if it's quite a long way from Australia to other places, and to need to have transmission lines to get solar in such a long distance seems to almost defeat the cause in terms of saying, well, that we might be half as cheap, but then if we're going to spend all that just getting it to Indonesia, say, in the first place, well, why don't they just put up their own solar there that's twice as expensive but doesn't matter because they don't have to ship it such a long distance?
Well, that's where I think the economic debate is going to come down to, pretty much exactly as you've put it. Obviously, we've been quite successful at exporting coal and gas and as LNG. Mm. And by the way, the LNG transport cost is pretty expensive by the time you've converted the gas to LNG and compressed it. It can be done and you can make good money out of it, but it's not a lay down bazaar. I'm sure, I don't know if your listeners are aware, that there are two $20 billion plus projects, separate projects, one in the Northern Territory and one in the Northwest Shelf of Australia, that are aiming to, one, to export hydrogen to Indonesia and Asia, as well as essentially supplying cheap energy to the iron ore industry and associated parts of the Northwest Shelf. And that's a fascinating project. And then there's the project in the Northern Territory that aims to run a DC cable where the losses are next to nothing.
To Singapore.
To Singapore. And I mean, they're very interesting projects to follow, but again, if someone came round to me asking me to put some money into them today, I wouldn't be putting the house rent in. I might put a few race winnings in, assuming not having.
Very good.
So, coming back to, so you spoke a little bit about that, you know, as you said, it seems to be that there's been a lot of failures already in the planning ability of the Australian government for the new world. Are you expecting a new world of energy to sort of be similar in terms of what we have now? We've got a national electricity market and you just have cheaper and cheaper generation everywhere and maybe less and less solar and a few batteries to sort of but everything's sort of still shipped across state lines. Or are you expecting more about, like you're talking, you know, 60 houses or a couple hundred houses hooked into to sort of smaller power grids that are sort of more decentralized? Or are you expecting, you know, I guess the extreme when people just start going off grid completely?
I don't think people go off-grid completely because I don't think the economics are there for it, and those economics are never likely to be as good as staying connected to the main grid. So it's predicting the future is a real, really stupid game. You know what I mean? It's like I could point to countless examples where markets have been deregulated and the world's greatest experts said one thing and the exact opposite happened.
Usually prices will fall and actually rise. Yes.
Yeah, or they said they would, you know, like when stockbroking commissions were deregulated back in the late 1970s, people said it would be the end of the stockbroking industry. In fact, of course, it made turnover jump so much that stockbroking went on a run. It's only just ended a few years ago. The thing about electricity is it's hard to predict how the market's going to work, but my concept of it is that there's a lot of distributed energy, which increases resilience and security, but it's backed up by also lots of good transmission and lots of utility generation. So you can shift, I don't know, wind in Queensland to South Australia because the two are not correlated very heavily. And similarly, you know, just because of time differences, when it's lunchtime in Queensland, it's a lot earlier in South Australia. Mm. So, you know, solar can go from Queensland to South Australia at Queensland's lunchtime and back again at South Australia's lunchtime. So you've got this local market. Anyway, that's the way I think about it. As to how we get there and the planning and stuff, well, you know, like so many other things, there's not really very much good industry policy. My view is we haven't had much industry policy since the Button car plant was about the last time. And that was a long time ago. But I do think we could do with some forward-looking long-term industry policy. That's not necessarily picking winners. It's just having a plan and being flexible as to how things evolve in pursuing that plan.
Yes, I guess it's admitting their policy.
We want to keep our aluminium industries. We've got a lot of industries that are very energy intensive at the moment that are very vulnerable as a result of the change in electricity prices. So aluminium would be an obvious one, but data centres would be another, as I said, to think of a more modern concept. Paper manufacturing, there's a whole lot of industries that are energy intensive, and at the moment their problem is how to survive. In theory, Australia, once we fully change the world economy in every country, not just Australia, these guys will have a competitive energy advantage again. But they may be dead long before that happens. So this is the kind of role of industry policy is an extent to think about what do we want to keep and how do we want to shape things? Do we want to be an energy-intensive economy going forward or not?
And it would, I guess it sounds like we're on the same page there. Then that it seems to be it's just drifting. There's an idea of where we should be going, but nobody's sort of everyone's just taking it incrementally one closure at a time. What's the next one closing down? Okay, how are we going to solve that one? Okay, what's after that? You know, or wait until that one happens first, and then worry about the next one.
The three year political cycle doesn't help things, and there's obviously a complete lack of consensus. Look, I don't want to get into the ideology side of things, but to me, it's stuffed. I mean, to people who operate in the industry, everyone knows, broadly speaking, in the electricity industry itself, where things are going to end up. And it's just so irritating to find so much sand being thrown in the gears all the time.
Yeah. And so the question is, you know, from an investor's perspective is always, you know, you're going to try and invest in the guy who's gaming the system for today's inefficiencies, but if they actually do make changes, is going to miss out. Or are you going to go for the forward-thinking ones that are actually trying to position themselves for tomorrow, but at the cost of not gaming the current system enough? Have you got
investing is a very difficult business, and as I'm sure you're aware, for most people, just you know, my view has having been a top three analyst for more than 30 years and the only one I know of to have rated number one in three different sectors in Greenwich, but I couldn't keep doing that year after year, that's for sure. That it's very, very difficult to pick winners, but certainly they require a good product, a good market, and a good operator. And of those, a good management. And of all those, I probably would rather have the management first if you can actually identify them.
And then you've got to buy it. So then you've got to buy it at the right price as well.
Then you've got to buy it at the right price. So it's very difficult to make good money in renewable energy because you're basically, the basic fundamental is that demand is flat. Yep. So you're trying to push a new supply into flat demand. You know, that's a fundamentally difficult thing to do.
And the person who builds something today and versus the guy who builds it next year, the guy who builds it next year is cheaper, is lower cost than the guy who just built it today.
Yeah, you don't mind that so much. That's true, but you don't mind that so much if you've got a revenue PPA. Like, for instance, one of the worst wind farms in Australia is the MacArthur Wind Farm, currently still the biggest operating one. And yet, because of the falling interest rates and the great revenue contract that thing has got, its price has gone up and up and up. You know, it's selling for, despite the fact it's a complete dog in terms of the way it actually works, its value is about twice what it was when it started.
Yeah.
So that's an example of how you've got to, you know, markets are, you've really got to understand what you're talking about in markets. It's no good going in with half idea. Mm. So I like some of the lithium stocks, or particularly I would say that if you, and I'm sure you're your investors know this better than me. If you're going to operate in the commodity industry, you want to be with the guy that's quality and low cost, because commodity cycles go up and down. And the first requirement is to be able to survive the bad times. And then, you know, you can leverage up on the crap stocks as when the price is very high. So, you know, stocks like Orocobre that have, as was mentioned in the financial review, that basically have much lower costs than most of their competitors, you know, nice stocks to own when the price is down.
Of I guess, the big utilities, so the AGLs and Alintas and Origins,
you can't buy Alinta. You can only buy AGL and Origin and APA. Yeah. In the bigger scale of things, I guess, you know, if interest rates are falling, APA has been the place to be.
In terms of quality side, where would you rate, I guess, you spoke about the quality of management versus and the types of assets they're trying to position themselves in?
Look, I think that the CEOs of both AGL and Origin are pretty good at the moment. I've got a lot of respect for Brett Redman at AGL, though he's relatively new to the job. But his coal assets ultimately are going to be a big liability for him. Particularly MacGen was the reason why he bought it cheap those years ago, and they've made very good money out of it. But now it's in a fairly difficult situation. There's something like $1 billion closure liability. They don't publish that number anymore. It somehow disappeared, but that's what they've got. And Origin has still struggling to find a direction. Both of them, as we said, we started this podcast talking about the behind-the-meter household market and how much it's grown, the 9 gigawatts, and neither AGL or Origin have really found a good way into that, and that's where all the growth and the real market is at the moment.
Some of the,
of course, if Origin found some gas, not even gas, but found some oil at Beetaloo in the Northern Territory, that might be a whole new story. But you can't, you know, really invest on that alone.
Yeah, well, overseas, we've sort of, in our international investments, we've sort of found some good investments in terms of looking for the companies that are sort of doing a lot of the servicing or the effectively the plugging into networks of various things and in that service industry. Do you find in Australia there's any particular companies that you sort of look at that you sort of put in that higher quality group of companies on the service side?
No, but I'd certainly like to find one. I mean, I think unfortunately, all the solar installers are mostly privately owned. I mean, we've got some of the lowest installation costs in the world for rooftop solar, an incredibly efficient and great workforce that does it. But it's not that easy to invest in.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking more on the utility side, less on the residential side.
So, there are people like Downer, I guess, and UGL, which is part of Simic now.
Those pretty broadly diversified.
So the answer is no. Nothing comes instantly to mind. I wish it did.
Yeah. Excellent.
Okay. Look, Dave, just one quick one I had, forgive me if this is a thought bubble, but we've got a note down here just on Australia potentially becoming a renewable superpower, and we've spoken a little bit about the supply, and you mentioned before this potential link to Singapore, which is interesting, selling a lot of newspaper column inches, I'm sure. Do you think there's potential for a broad scale, whether it be solar or wind sort of array, coupled with, a government policy that would perhaps, and we were talking before a bit about the erosion of, energy intensive industry in Australia to build out something on, whether it be on the outsides of Victoria or one of our, major cities, where we could effectively create like an industrial cheap power zone or something like that. It's just something that's always kicked along in the back of my mind. Is that sort of something that would ever, do you think that would ever see the light of day, as it were? Sorry, pardon the pun. But
well, you could certainly have world-class competitive renewable energy in Australia. I think there's no doubt about that at all. And if you could put a DC power link and send it to pretty much anywhere where there's activity. Big business is mostly driven by, the reason why we don't have aluminium factories in Wagga or Bendigo is because, by and large, they're bad places to get the aluminum or other raw materials into and out of. Now, it's very hard to decentralise when your workforce and most of your raw materials have to be either imported or exported. So I would say it's easier to move the electricity to where the factories is than the other way around. But look, these things are quite complicated economically, obviously, and I'm a great believer in markets, as well as thinking that at the moment we need some just general policy and ideas. So I just think there's an awful lot we could do to make the transition to cheaper or efficient electricity a lot better than it's going at the moment, which would start by building more transmission and perhaps by giving a few incentives to household batteries, a few incentives to electric vehicles, for instance, free parking in the CBDs of Sydney and Melbourne and Brisbane. Would be an incredible incentive that would cost next to nothing because there are hardly any electricity vehicles. So to start with, it cost nothing, but it would really incentivise people who want to drive and park in town to actually get in there and do it, and it was incredibly successful in Norway when they did it. Mm-hmm. There's just so much more that you can do without having to make massive bets. Like building a few more transmission lines in a hurry is not really a massive bet, you know, because transmission's a relatively small part of the electricity cost. It's just a matter of actually doing it.
Okay. And I guess on that vein, we've spoken a lot about energy supply and the energy market. From a demand perspective, have you done any work at all on the electric vehicle, perhaps a phenomenon or boom that perhaps is in front of us, whether or not Australia is going to be fully taken up on that boom over some of the other countries? But do you see that having a material impact on, I guess, the energy market in general?
Or the quantum? Have you sort of got some idea of the quantum of, is that sort of a...
Yeah, so if you're 100% electrified, and you can work this all out. I'll give you some of the ways I used to think about it. I probably won't remember the exact answer, but broadly, if you look at a Tesla Model S, it gets about 19 kilowatt hours to 100 kilometres, right? And so you know that broadly a petrol car is, say, 8 litres per 100 kilometres. So you can say a litre is equal to 2.5 kilometre hours or something like that, yeah?
Right.
And then you can look at how many litres of fuel are consumed in Australia and convert that to kilowatt hours and then terawatt hours, and you roughly work out that if every vehicle kilometre driven in Australia was done by electric rather than petrol or diesel, it would come to something like a 45% increase in total electricity demand. So very significant.
Wow.
But not absolutely massive in the sense that it's going to take a long time to get to 100% electric vehicles. But that is not the end of the story, because if you get right into the decarbonisation theme, you'll find out that there is the people who really believe this really want to electrify most industrial processes. So, again, if you look at the LNG industry, as you're probably aware, all the upstream, that is the gas gathering in Queensland, and wells are driven by, and compression upstream are done by electricity. And it's one of the ironies that you have like coal-fired electricity in Queensland making gas to send to China where it replaces coal.
Wow.
And that's not quite true. I just make that as a bit of a joke. But the actual LNG compression facilities on Curtis Island are all done using the gas itself. But it's that sort of process that could in turn be electrified that would again increase demand for electricity and help us to decarbonise the total economy in the way that most of us think is inevitable over time.
And the other issue, I guess, with that 45% is that it's at least that 45% is probably generatable during the day. So as you said, when we hit that zero stage where the solar is really, really cheap, then So there's not quite a 45. We don't need a 45% increase in the whole of our network because if you can
park
generate
up all the cars in that one prime zone of generation.
Right now, the problem for the utility guys is that the demand that they see is actually falling. It's falling at a rate of about 1% per year cumulatively.
Yeah.
Maybe that fall is actually accelerating at the moment because there's been such a growth in behind the meter demand. So yes, that's where I think some policies. Anyway, don't start me, but something to help the electric vehicles. I mean, there's nothing to help electric vehicles in Australia. It's just crazy. We don't even have a fuel standards policy, as you know. I only read in today that the new Skoda hybrid model won't come to Australia because our low sulfur fuels are so crap. You know, I mean, Australia has, we use crap coal in our coal generation plants, very low quality, air quality, bad air quality, and we use crap petrol. Some of the, you know, no standards.
Mm.
Australia just put up with it. Mm.
Fantastic. Okay, Dave, well, look, mindful of your time, and look, thanks very much for all the insight today. Where can our listeners follow your work?
Well, I publish a lot of articles for free at Renew Economy, just because, as I said, I want to put something back. But our website for people who want to engage in consulting services or get our electricity price forecasts is itkservices.com.au.
Okay, fantastic. Look, thanks again for coming on. We look forward to getting you along on the next one.
Thanks very much for having me. Have a great day. Cheers.
Thanks, David. So, Damien, terrific 50-odd minutes there spent with David Leach, a guy who certainly knows what he's talking about when it comes to Australian energy and global energy markets.
Yeah, so look, some good insights. Obviously, he's got a different view to me on the immediacy. I think he's sort of talking more, and I guess he didn't even want to lead into to how far away it is that I think we're sort of both on the same page. I think eventually that batteries and solar is where we're going to, but he's sort of steering very much away from making a forecast, whereas I'm
all about making forecasts.
I'm all about making, yeah. Well, I'm all about, I guess, looking at what looks most likely and putting probabilities on factors.
Yep.
And at the moment, looking at something that's falling 20% per annum on both batteries and solar.
Gets your attention.
And saying, you know, this is, I don't think it's going to stop dead.
Yep.
I think it could very easily slow, and especially solar is starting to get, you know, very close to the to the stage anyway where it doesn't actually make that much difference to the overall cost because the costs are already so low. But I do think battery costs are going to keep coming down, and so that's where I'm sort of playing. But I guess some of the parts that I found quite interesting, you know, downside to coal, I think that's very much been a theme of ours as well. But, you know, it's that same point that saying, you know, China's got this overcapacity.
Mm.
And if you've got an overcapacity in coal and an overcapacity in solar, one of them costs you coal to, you know, to if you want to produce more power, you need to pump more coal into it.
Yep.
If you want to produce more power on the solar, you just need to leave it switched on.
Yep.
And so if you've got an overcapacity issue and you start seeing slowing demand, then it's not going to be the solar that gets turned off.
Yep, well, great point.
Not
yep.
without vested interests. Yeah, sort of. But yeah, it's most likely to be the coal that gets switched off. I think there was certainly some of his thoughts on electricity prices within Australia, and I guess that there's no real you know, confirming what we'd thought, but it's good to hear it from different sources that, you know, there's nothing really coming on the electricity price front that you'd call a saviour to the high electricity prices in Australia. If you started from scratch and turned around and looked at a country and said, okay, you've got a country that's first highly urbanized, so you know you've
got centralized big
groups of people all living in the same places, and you've got you're the world's biggest producer of world's biggest exporter of gas and world's biggest exporter of coal. You'd expect that country to also have very low electricity prices.
You would,
whereas we don't.
Mm.
We're some of the highest, and so and that's sort of been a group effort, I guess, from both sides of politics and you know, all around.
All around vested interests.
That's right. But as David's, you know, said on numerous occasions, we just don't even have plans to fix all of this. And that you know, I think some of the areas I am interested in looking a little bit deeper is some of these the DC power links and just seeing the costs. I know there are low losses on that, but it's probably worth having a bit of a closer look in terms of some of those projects. Just to make sure that, you know, keeping up to speed with the technologies.
Mm.
And the other one is that, look, the companies are very much struggling. In Australia, companies are struggling because when your government doesn't have a plan and your companies are sort of not sure whether they're doing one thing or doing another, and, you know, they've obviously got big coal assets for AGL that are being shut down, and I guess lack of vision on renewables for the other one is you sort of end up with the companies sort of stuck in a bit of a rut, which just sort of goes to show that, or goes to say to me that, you know, we're sort of steering clear of those and finding something where it's a bit easier. Yep. You know, quite possibly some of these will make a bit of money for you, but when you have companies with a very, very uncertain outlook and from both the policy side and from internal, I find it's better. It's a big world. There's thousands of companies out there. We'll find a company that's got less risk attached to the return.
Yep. Okay. Well said. Well, that's it for now, and thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe, give us your email address, and in return we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.